Hey, what you're about to listen to is the podcast version of what was a live radio segment on KPFA. Consequently, when you hear us give out a call-in number, you don't want to call it. If you're listening to this as a podcast, it is already too late, and nobody on the other end of that phone number is going to have any useful answers for you. All right, let's go to this week's Corona Calls. We're going to turn, as we do most weeks at this time, to new developments in the world of COVID-19. Our guest is Dr. John Swartzberg, Clinical Professor Emeritus of Infectious Diseases at UC Berkeley School of Public Health. Good morning, Dr. Swartzberg.
Good morning.
A couple new studies that have been published that I wanted to run through before we get to listener questions. The first was put out in the Journal of the American Heart Association. It is a systematic review and meta-analysis, meaning they are rounding up all the other research in existence. And their systematic analysis and meta-analysis comes to the conclusion that for a number of infectious diseases, most prominently influenza and COVID, there's a dramatic increase in the risk of heart attack and stroke in the period immediately following infection. For influenza, in 1 month period following infection, the risks went up 5 times for stroke, 4 times for heart attacks. For COVID, the period they saw in effect was 14 weeks following infection, and it was a tripling in risk for both outcomes. What's new here? What's of note here?
Yeah, this was nice to see, and because it builds on multiple articles we've been seeing over the last couple of years, actually longer than that, and that is the recognition that these respiratory infections, and not necessarily just respiratory infections, shingles would be another example. When you get an infectious disease that may manifest itself in the respiratory tree or on the skin, like with shingles, but what in addition is going on is inflammation throughout the body. The amount of inflammatory response to these infections goes up throughout the body. And we know that the inflammatory response can damage blood vessels, particularly the real small arteries, but even some of the medium-sized arteries as well. And the arteries that are most vulnerable to this are the arteries that feed the heart and feed the brain. So we call this cardiovascular disease in general because those are the two major areas. There are other areas of the body too, but those are the two major areas. So when we get an acute inflammatory disease like influenza, COVID, shingles, others, we cause more damage to these vessels. And the result may be, if you're predisposed to having cardiovascular disease by either a high cholesterol, for example, or just by your age, then you're at greater risk over the next, in this case, short period of time, month, 2 months, 3 months, but in other studies, up to a year, a greater risk of having a stroke or having a heart attack. And so this study sort of puts a cap on a lot of literature that we've been seeing bubble up over the last few years.
Does the risk reduce to normal after those periods, or do we just not have enough data to say what happens to the risk after those periods?
Well, the data that we have now suggests that the risk is highest shortly after the event, within a month, 2 months, 3 months. But clearly the risk has been demonstrated out to a year, and we don't have a lot of data beyond that. So we have to see what that means. But I think the message here is pretty clear, and that is when you get vaccinated for an infectious disease, it is likely going to reduce your risk not only of getting that infectious disease, or if you get it, make it much milder, that is decrease inflammation. But the other salutary effect of that is that it's going to reduce the possibility of you having a heart attack and a stroke over what you would have had if you didn't get vaccinated. So this fits right into our understanding of the what we call pathophysiology, or how disease occurs, with our understanding of the role of prevention of infectious diseases and how that leads to not only better short-term health by not getting or modifying that infectious disease, but better long-term health by preventing strokes and heart attacks.
So this was a suggestion in the article, not a conclusion of the meta-analysis, but it seems fairly obvious. Getting vaccinated reduces your chances of getting the infection in the first place. If you don't get the infection, you don't get the heightened risk of heart attack and stroke. What is less clear, or at least not documented with ironclad evidence to date, is if you get a milder case of illness because of vaccination, is there a commensurate decrease in your risk of heart attack and stroke? It would stand to reason that there is, but we don't know for sure.
That's a very good critique. We don't know for sure, but as you said, it stands to reason. Now, we can't base medical decisions on it stands to reason, or we shouldn't, because we need data. But I think that right now there's a compelling reason to get vaccinated to prevent heart attacks and strokes, because it will prevent some people from getting infected.
Speaking to Dr. John Swartzberg, clinical professor emeritus of infectious diseases at UC Berkeley School of Public Health. One more piece of new research to run through, then we'll be taking your questions. 1-800-958-9008. 1-800-958-9008 for your corona calls. All right, the second article I wanted to discuss just came out in Nature. It is entitled SARS-CoV-2 mRNA Vaccine Sensitized Tumors to Immune Checkpoint Blockade. The long and the short of which, and this gets densely into biological process that I have only the faintest understanding of, that for cancer patients receiving immunotherapy, there may be a beneficial effect from getting the Pfizer or Moderna COVID vaccines, the mRNA vaccines for COVID, because they apparently improve the body's response to the immunotherapy targeting their tumors as well, which seemed kind of out of left field. But I was wondering if you can explain it better than I do.
Well, you did a nice job explaining it. This is an exciting paper, and it is a little bit out of left field. You're right. The reason it's exciting is because the data was very compelling in terms of studies in animals, particularly in mice, that demonstrated this very clearly. Now, mice are not humans, but we have other data now in humans that are consistent with what we're seeing in mice. And the data in humans are observational studies, so we need controlled studies, which would be ideal. But these observational studies showed us that people who got the mRNA vaccine, Pfizer or Moderna, and were receiving, as you said, Brian, a certain type of cancer treatment, what are called checkpoint inhibitors, which these inhibitors allow the immune system, in particular what we call T cells, to recognize cancer and the cancer cells and destroy them. But the cancer cells have learned how to camouflage themselves from some of these immune checkpoint inhibitors, either at the beginning or after a while taking them. When people got the mRNA vaccine within 100 days of getting the checkpoint inhibitors worked much better, and they added significant time to survival in patients who got the mRNA vaccines compared to those who did not. Now, again, I want to emphasize that this is an observational study that's based upon good animal data, but it clearly needs repeating in other centers, as well as in these centers that did it. I want to just make sure that everybody who's listening understands this was demonstrated in people who get a certain type of immunotherapy, these checkpoint inhibitors. It was not demonstrated, and it wasn't looked for in people who get other types of cancer chemotherapy. So that's important to keep in mind, that it's really at this point with a selected type of cancer chemotherapy, or with a selected type of cancer therapy.
So I'm very comfortable with the idea that drugs and vaccines and other medical interventions can have, benefits that were unanticipated and not what they were designed for. I don't fully understand why it would have occurred to these researchers to investigate the question of whether the two COVID mRNA vaccines improve the performance of a specific type of intervention against cancer. Like, where did the hypothesis come from that is now generating this research?
Right. Well, it really originated in the thinking that these mRNA vaccines create two types of immune responses. They create a specific immune response to what the mRNA is coding for, but they also cause a generalized type of immune response. And the researchers hypothesized that this generalized type of immune response, for example, increase in interferon levels, might uncover cancer cells that otherwise were camouflaged to not allow our immune system to recognize. So that was the basic hypothesis. And what followed from that were studies in mice that clearly demonstrated this. And what followed from that was the observational studies in humans that were receiving checkpoint inhibitors, where the data also was consistent with what we saw in mice and what we thought about the hypothesis.
So would that hypothesis hold for any vaccine, or is there some specific attribute of the mRNA vaccines that made them a good candidate for this research?
Right now, it appears that it's the mRNA vaccines, and it may not be the RNA by itself. It may be the RNA in the lipid coat that it's put in. So there's a lot of work now to be done to really understand, is it the combination of the mRNA with the lipid coating, or is it something more, or is it just the lipid coating? So to be continued.
All right. If you'd like to put a question to Dr. John Swartzberg, the number is 1-800-958-9008. That's 1-800-958-9008. And if you want to read up on the studies we just mentioned, I will post them in the show notes on the Corona Calls podcast feed. Just look for Corona Calls wherever you get your podcasts or on the website kpfa.org. First on the phone lines, we've got Ron in Gasquite. Good morning, Ron.
Yes.
Ron, you're on the air. What's your question?
Hello.
Hello, Ron.
Hello.
What's your question?
Yes, I'm there. I'm 75. I have leukemia. Is it better to get the newer iteration of the booster, or should I just go with the Moderna? I am due to have my last shot. It's probably been 5 months, 4 or 5.
Thank you, Ron. Dr. Swartzberg.
Thanks, Ron, for that question. I hope you're doing well with the leukemia. And yes, you clearly, because you have that medical problem, you are a candidate and you should get the mRNA vaccine, or at least vaccinated against COVID. I presume that's what you're talking about. In terms of the type of vaccine, what I think you were referring to from Moderna is what's called the M-NEX spike. That's what they call it. And this is a different vaccine, a different thinking about the vaccine than what we've seen previously. It's an mRNA vaccine like the other Moderna vaccine and the Pfizer vaccine. But essentially what this vaccine does is it elicits a focused immune response onto the two areas of the spike protein that appear to be the critical areas where, when we develop antibodies to those two areas, that's what seems to give us the best protection. Whereas the previous mRNA vaccines gave a more generalized immune response to the entire spike protein. So you could think of this new M-NEX spike more like a rifle than the previous mRNA vaccines more like a shotgun. The advantages of the new mRNA vaccine, the M-NEX spike, we just don't know a lot about yet. We know that in the studies that led up to its approval, when compared to the other mRNA vaccines, it appeared to be equivalent in terms of the immune response. There were some hints that maybe it would even give us a little better protection than the other two, but those were only hints, and I wouldn't base a lot on that right now. We're not going to really know how effective this is until we have at least 6 months under our belt of studying how people did getting this mNEX spike compared to the previous mRNA vaccines. The other advantages aren't so much for the individual, but there are big advantages of this mNEX spike, and that is that it contains less mRNA, almost about a tenth of the amount that you get in the other two, which can translate into, we think, fewer reactions. Maybe your arm won't be so sore, or you won't get fever, or you won't get the bad body aches. But again, it's too preliminary to really make too much out of that. We'll know much more in several months.
Presumably, it also means they can manufacture more quicker if they're trying to get a lot of vaccine out the door in response to a surge in a new variant.
That's right. The other advantages really are that it has a better shelf life and that it doesn't have to be kept as cold as the other vaccines. So those aren't the advantages for the individual, but if we could have these vaccines have a much longer shelf life and not require that real low temperature that we have to keep the vaccines at, that's going to make them much more available. So it really helps with the logistics. So possibly some advantages for the human, we don't know yet. Clearly some advantages logistically. So we'll have to see in a number of months if all this pans out.
You know, let me pick up on that note and read you one from the inbox, Dr. Swartzberg. James, no city mentioned, wrote in, he says, my wife is 76 and I am 79. We received our last COVID booster in June. When should we get our next one? And he asks as a second part to the question, how long should we wait between the influenza vaccine and the COVID vaccine? This is the first I've heard of waiting between the two vaccines. Kaiser, where I get my shots, we'll put them both in the same arm at the same time, happily, just to get you vaccinated. Is there any reason to do that?
There's no reason to wait between them. This has been studied adequately now, and we know that you can get both vaccines at the same time, either in the same arm like you got it, Brian, or in separate arms if you prefer. But you can get them at the same time. Some people who get a pretty bad reaction, have fever and body aches and feel rotten for a couple of days to the COVID vaccine, and maybe they got reactions to the flu vaccine, they may want to separate the two by a few days, a week or 2 weeks, whatever they choose. So that's fine too. It's really a personal choice on that. From a public health standpoint, it makes a lot more sense to get them at the same time. It's one trip to the pharmacy or your doctor's office, and you're much more likely to get both of the vaccines if you do it that way, because you may get the COVID vaccine and then just blow off the flu vaccine otherwise. So it's fine to get them at the same time. The question about when James should get the, and James and his wife should get the next COVID vaccine, it depends. If all else is equal, roughly every 6 months at that age, I think is reasonable at this time. That's what I would typically do. The reason I say it depends is, let's say that James and his wife have a real important wedding to go to that they really don't want to miss, and they want to be protected for that. It's been over 4 months. And in that circumstance, then I'd probably get the COVID vaccine a couple of weeks before that event, or they have a big trip coming up. So you can individuate your decision somewhat. I'd wait at least 4 months if you're in good health at that age. And if you can wait 6 months and there's nothing coming up, then that's absolutely fine to do.
And this is because all else being equal, the longer the interval between vaccine shots, the better the immune response to the dose.
Thank you. That's correct. We know that if you get them like in 2 months or 3 months or 4 months, you don't get quite as big a bang for the buck when you get the next booster. as compared to waiting 6 months. But after 4 months, the difference between after 4 months and 6 months is not very great. So that's why I don't think 6 months is some ironclad rule.
All right. Let's go to Richmond next, where Jean is on the line. Good morning, Jean.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. My question is about taking Paxlovid. I got my only case of COVID almost 2 years ago, but I've been confused ever since. I was told no, I could not have Paxlovid because I didn't test positive until what I was counting as day four. And the doctor had her assistant call me and say, that's too late, because you wouldn't be starting Paxlovid probably until day five by the time you get it from the pharmacy and so on. And I said, well, can I challenge that? She said, try a pharmacist. I did that. And the pharmacist said, how did you count the days of infection? And she said, oh, you're wrong, because the first day of symptoms is day zero. I did not know that. And then she proceeded to prescribe Paxlovid for me. So could you kind of break that down for people? Because I'm sure I'm not the only one who's confused by that or about that.
Jane, Dr. Swartzberg, I think Jane's broken it down pretty well. Go ahead.
She really has. And I'm really glad that she called and gave the listeners that information, because she's absolutely right. That is, the pharmacist was absolutely right. And that is, the first day of your symptoms, or the first day you test positive, whichever is the longest, is day zero. So if I got sick today, or if I was exposed to somebody and I wanted to test it, if I was positive or not, even though I'm feeling well and I tested positive today, that's day zero. So day one is actually the next day. So Jane was clearly within the 5-day window to get the vaccine. Her question also brought up a point that I've made in talking with you, Brian, a long time ago. And that is, it's important to understand how COVID can make you really sick. When we initially get sick from COVID, it's really the virus replicating in the beginning of our immune response to that. And that's what's giving us all the symptoms. And in the typical situation, after several days, our immune response is able to control the viral replication, and we start to get better, and the immune response tapers off. In some people, and we don't know how to predict who that is, in some people, they get the immune response and it doesn't shut off, and it keeps accelerating, even though the amount of viral replication has dropped. And it's that accelerating immune response that can really make us terribly ill and wind us up in the hospital. And that typically occurs on day 5, 6, 7, 8. So if you're starting to get better, if you're feeling pretty well on day 2, 3, and 4, that is not terribly bad. A lot of doctors will say, well, then don't bother to take the Paxlovid. But if you're older, for example, or you have underlying conditions that predispose you to a bad outcome, it doesn't matter how you're really doing in the first few days of illness. If you're a candidate for the Paxlovid or another drug to treat the virus, don't say, well, I'm not doing that badly, I'm going to wait and see if I get worse, because you could get worse awfully quickly. And by then, the Paxlovid's not going to be of value.
Mm. Kind of calls to mind another lesson here, which is the concern that she wouldn't be able to start the prescription until a day after she got the prescription. The 5-day cutoff is not a binary. My understanding is the earlier in the course of infection you start Paxlovid, the more effective it is at reducing the severity of infection. So if you're someone who's medically vulnerable who would be eligible for Paxlovid if you got infected, it's worth thinking through kind of what your plan is going to be to get it quickly if you need it. Who are you going to be able to get to write that prescription? Where are you going to be able to get it filled, even if it's after hours or on a weekend when your doctor's not in their office?
Absolutely. Well put, Brian.
All right. Dr. Swartzberg, we're going to leave it there for this week. Thank you so much for spending another Monday morning with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
All right, that does it for this week's edition of Corona Calls. If you want to send in a question for next week's, you can email coronacalls@kpfa.org. Or tune in live to Call In Live. Usually we air Monday mornings right after 7:30 news headlines on KPFA 94.1 FM in the Bay Area or kpfa.org anywhere in the world. We put a little bit of extra work into repackaging this live segment as a podcast because it feels like the information is useful to a lot of people. We ought to make it accessible through as many channels as possible. You can help us get the word out by rating and reviewing it in whatever app you're using to listen. And if you want to pitch in some cash, we wouldn't say no. We always take donations at kpfa.org. I appreciate it if you mentioned Corona Calls when you make your pledge. My name is Brian Edwards-Tiekert. I hope you have a great week. Stay well. We'll talk to you next time.